I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Sally Armstrong joins me now. She's got a new book out, Ascent of Women. It's an often gripping, dramatic, and enlightening book about how the advancement of women is the key to ending poverty, violence, and conflict. And the interesting thing is that it's in the developing world where it's gaining momentum most. Sally Armstrong is the ideal person to tell these stories, having covered Afghanistan for many years. As well, her on-the-ground reporting throughout the world has won countless awards, including three from Amnesty International. She's received six honorary doctorate degrees and is a member of the Order of Canada. In this book, she tells us of women leading the way in making change happen, whether it's Nobel Prize winners or folks in business and government, to women in the developing world getting small loans so they can break the cycle of poverty, to little girls who've been raped and abused who are suing for justice. It's an informative and compelling book, and I'll get Ms. Armstrong to tell us about it. As well, I'll ask her about some of the fascinating and inspiring women she's encountered along the way. The book is published by Random House. There's an event with the Writers Festival here in Vancouver Monday night, the 25th of March, at St. Andrews Wesley. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for more information on that. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Toronto, Sally Armstrong. Ms. Armstrong, good morning.
Hi, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be with you online.
In reading the book and reading the stories that you tell and meeting the women that you talk about in the book, I guess the first question I have is, would the world be a better place if women were in charge?
You ask good questions, Joseph. I don't think anybody's suggesting that. But I think we can easily and clearly state that the world is a lesser place by keeping women away from the table.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing in the book, that the quote that I pulled, that women are more interested in fairness rather than power, in peace versus a piece of turf. I guess this lack of engagement of say, half the population, if they were engaged, that would essentially mean affecting poverty and conflict, right?
Well, this is what the researchers are coming up with now, and it's all kind of, it's like the stars are lining up. Women are starting to ask questions they never dared to ask before. They're saying, show me where it says in the Quran that I can't go to work or my daughter can't go to school. Women are challenging what have been so-called cultural customs that they never challenged before. Women in Senegal are saying, why do we do, they call it excision in Senegal, they're saying, why do we do female genital mutilation? Who said we should do that? And finding out nobody knows. So they said, well, then we're not doing it anymore. And at the same time, women are better educated, but there's more than, it's a grassroots movement that is now being fed by the policy wonks and the researchers. People like Jeffrey Sachs, the Millennium Goals economist, saying the status of women in the economy are directly related. Where one's flourishing, so is the other. Where one's in the ditch, so is the other. You have support for this change coming from places it never came from before. And it's almost a chicken and egg thing. Is it because the grassroots movement is so strong, or is it because the policy wonks and big shots are starting to say things that are feeding the emancipation of women? Well, whatever it is, the tide has definitely turned.
Well, why has it taken so long, though?
Well, isn't that an excellent question? You know, as I wrote this book, I went back in history to see, first of all, why were women oppressed, and who drove that bus through centuries. And then I knew around 3 years ago that things were changing. So why has it changed? I think education is certainly a big piece of it. You know, in Afghanistan, the women refer to their illiteracy as being blind. Mm. I said, what do you mean you were blind? And they said, this one woman said, I couldn't see. I couldn't read, so I couldn't see what was going on. I thought, in fewer than a dozen words, this woman totally hit the nail on the head. That the thugs in power keep people illiterate so they can't see what's going on. Well, today, people can see what's going on, and this has been quick. Because as soon as you ask that question you've never been allowed to ask before, as soon as you say, show me in the Quran where it says my daughter can't go to school, you've made a huge change already. And then this moves like a grass fire. It passes along also with social networks. Look at the value of internet, of Facebook, Twitter, getting the word out person to person. And so it's moved very, very rapidly, I think, number one, because of education. Number two, because the world is in touch one place to the other, and people are finding out other people don't live like this. Why do we live like this?
So, I mean, you've just mentioned that education is key, and there's another great line in the book, you educate the girl, you educate the village. Why do you think it doesn't happen in equal measure with boys in the developing world?
Well, you know, there's a level of impunity that you and I find it difficult to understand. The impunity of men in Africa, for example, is astonishing. In Kenya, where I've been following a case of 160 little girls between the ages of 3 and 17 who are suing their government for failing to protect them from being raped, they have all the laws they need in Kenya for rape. In fact, if you rape a child under the age of 15, you get life in prison. So it's not about the fact that the laws aren't there. It's about the fact that men have impunity and always have had. It's been seen as women's lot in life to be oppressed, to be raped, to be used badly. Now suddenly the women are saying, not anymore. And the men are kind of saying, huh? What happened here? So, the men have to do a lot of changing.
Now, you mentioned that the information age has sped up the process a great deal. It's empowered nearly everyone now. In the developing world, throughout your travels, where have you seen this? Have you seen technology change society the most?
Well, I can't say where I've seen it change the most, but I can tell you where I've seen it the most recently changing, and that would be a group called Young Women for Change in Afghanistan. Now, get a load of these numbers. These young women told me that 67% of the population of Afghanistan is under the age of 30. And they said, we never fought a war. Yeah. We never caused a war. We never took part in a war. We hate these old customs that are hurtful to people. And we want change. And what's the kicker? They said, we have the tools to make change. We have Facebook. We have Twitter. We're online. And these young people are prepared. Well, you know, every great movement is run by young people, and they're prepared to make the bold statements that lead to change. I said to them, well, what are you saying to the fundamentalists who will accuse you of westernizing Afghanistan every time someone even hints at change in Afghanistan? All these old people say, well, you're just trying to westernize the country. And these kids said, oh, we tell them, you think human rights are Western? You think treating people decently is Western? You think girls' education is Western? Well, if that's Western, what's Eastern?
Yeah.
They're pretty bold.
Yeah. You mentioned that this case of the Kenyan women who were suing over rape. What I found interesting in reading your book was that was of the role that Canadian jurisprudence played there.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
So here's what happened. There were... Canada is the country where the women sued the government for failing to protect them and won. Remember the Jane Doe case, remember all those Leaf cases.
Yeah.
And so the Kenyan and Kenyan women human rights lawyers, as well as human rights lawyers from Ghana and Malawi, were in Toronto studying at the law school, and they met up with Canadian women human rights lawyers, and they said, by the way, how the heck did you do that? And they told them, but they said, if you want us to help you, we will. So it's the Canadian women working with the African women on this case, and now it's gone to court.
Yeah, and so when do you think a resolution in that case will happen? Is that this year or next year?
I don't know. Joseph, I'm hoping it will be soon, but believe me, the old boys in power are going to throw everything they have at this courtroom, but every single person I interviewed, from judges to lawyers, magistrates, the public, everybody said the girls are going to win. So when will it be? I can't guess. I'm not in that business.
And I just realized that we're talking about it. People listening to this might not know. I mean, these are girls who are, some are like 8, 9, 10, right?
The girls, the 160 girls, are between the ages of 3 and 17.
Really?
You see, there's this ghastly presumption in sub-Saharan Africa that having sex with a little girl will cure you of HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. And the younger the girl, the more powerful the cure. So it's practically an epidemic, the raping.
Yeah. What role do men have in improving the lot of women in life? I mean, other than, you know, stopping the abuse of women and the sort, what would you like to see more of in terms of the role that men play in all this?
Well, you know what? Without the men, it isn't going to happen. Men are at the finish line. That's where we end this whole story. It's when the men stand up and say, don't talk about that woman like that. That could be my sister. That could be my mother. That could be my daughter. And until men decide to censor other men for behavior that is unacceptable, you're not going to get there. But now there's so many men, even in places where oppression of women has been historical. I'll give you an example. In Afghanistan, they have a law, it's illegal, but they have a tribal law called BAD. And it means that if your tribe has a fight with my tribe and you win, I have to give you a little girl, sometimes two or three little girls, depending on the size of the harm done. And you can just imagine what they do with those little girls. So I was present when one little girl who'd been, as they call it, given in bad at the age of 4, and she escaped when she was 8, and she'd been tethered to a harness and used as a plow horse. She slept with the livestock. The men of the house would come out and use her at night as they wished. The kid was covered in scars from burns. It was just a disgrace, and I was with another man, standing beside another man, and I gestured to the little girl. I said, how can anyone do something like that to a little kid? And he said to me, we know it's wrong, but it's our way. Pretty powerful statement. You know it's wrong.
Yeah.
Then stop it. And so I think it also opens the door for people to hear the size of the wrong, the consequences of that wrong. And again, it comes back to the health and the economic viability of the village. If you're treating half the population badly, you're going to do badly.
How do you, in the course of your work, deal with having to I mean, these tragedies, these horrors that you talk about in the book that you've just mentioned now, I mean, some of these are unspeakable crimes and the sort. I mean, do you find it difficult when you're alone, say, at home, going, you know, you're about to fall asleep, I mean, having to deal with all this?
Well, I think you're right. You know, these are very scarring stories, and the lives of those women and girls do play in the back of my eyelids. But I'll tell you, Joseph, when I meet these people on assignment, they're pretty anxious to get their story out. I remember the first time I went to Afghanistan, it was a few months after the Taliban took over, and the women saying to me, you have to tell our story, you have to ask the Canadian women to become our voice. And so there's something in that, and they are journalistically, I think they're stories you feel very privileged to tell. But they are scarring stories.
Yeah. There seems to be a gap in what's happening around the world and what the media is reporting. I mean, just take the Congo, for example. I mean, the genocide and violence there is wildly unreported. Why do you think it is? I mean, I guess that's our fault as consumers of media?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on there. First of all, Congo is now in the news more than it was. Remember on Valentine's Day that Billion Women Rising. It happened in countries around the world, and it was based in Congo. I certainly wrote about Congo. But more than that, I can tell you, there is evidence in the paper almost daily that people are paying much, much more attention to the status of women. I think the story of Malala is one of the best examples. Remember the little girl who was shot by the Taliban going to school?
Mm-hmm.
She made the front page of every paper in the world. And you know, a few weeks ago I was in Victoria. I live part-time on Salt Spring Island. I was in Victoria and CTV called me and said, would you go over to our studio to do a news hit because Malala just got out of the hospital. And I thought, this is extraordinary. I mean, first of all, thank goodness the little girl is recovering. But this is extraordinary. Nobody wants to let that story go. And then there's the Jyoti Pandey, who was gang raped to death in India.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's letting that story go. There's Sahar Gul in Afghanistan. Remember the kid who was forced to marry underage, and the family she married into wanted to put her out on the street as a prostitute. She refused, and they tortured her.
Right, right.
And she was rescued. That would never have happened before. Their neighbors would never have reported her screaming before because she's only a girl. The police would never have investigated before because she's only a girl. Malala's story would never have made it to the front page. But it's as though these kids have become our daughters. We won't let go. We want to know what becomes of them. And just the action around their stories is peeling back very important layers that have to be examined in places like India and Pakistan, and layers that were never examined before. So I think we don't pay enough attention to Congo, that's for sure. But the attention being paid to the issues around the girl child, it's changed dramatically just in the last year.
So the book is rather hopeful, but I mean, I'm sure there's room for improvement, especially here in Canada. Where do you see where we could do better here in this country?
Well, we're certainly not at the finish line, and women will move toward that finish line, but there are a couple of rather outstanding issues in Canada, and it really saddens me to say this, because Canada's done so much. The women's movement has been so successful here. I dare say it's been the best-run movement for change in the world. But then you look at the case of Bountiful, which is in the book.
Yeah.
In Bountiful, British Columbia, as you know, there's a polygamous sect that lives there. And what polygamy does to women and children, the harms are enormous. And a very brilliant judge in British Columbia took on this case as a reference case to find out, was the law correct or not? And he concluded that not only was the law correct, the harms done in polygamy are horrendous. So everything was exposed, everything was laid out, and nothing has been done. Nothing. There's not been an arrest. There's not been a change. How can that happen in a country like Canada? That would be one example. Another example would be the treatment of Aboriginal women.
Mm-hmm.
And there's thousands of missing women from that highway of tears. What goes on here? Why are people not arresting the perpetrators? Why do people look the other way in the face of this kind of murderous horror? That disappoints me a lot, because this is the country that really set an example for the world, not only on how to alter the status of women, but how to bring justice to everybody. And Canadians are the first ones to respond to my articles, anyway, on the women of Afghanistan, on the women of Congo. They write letters, they raise the roof, they call the UN, they call their MP. It's time we did a little examining of the black eyes in our own country.
You mentioned Afghanistan. I mean, that's a place that you've spent a lot of time in. You've documented the progress there in previous books. But with a drawdown of troops in the next year or so, what will happen to the lot of women there, and especially with the possibility that the Taliban will come back?
Well, first of all, I don't believe for one second that the Taliban are going to come back.
Uh-huh.
I believe the Taliban is a ragtag bunch of 20-something illiterates. That's what they started out as. That's what they are still. I don't believe for one second they're going to come back, and I'm very surprised at the amount of ink they're getting and the number of invitations they're getting to come to the meeting table, although I do agree that you have to negotiate with the enemy to get a peace. What do I think is going to happen? I think Afghanistan is going to stumble forward. They're going to have their problems. Certainly, the remnants of the Taliban are going to do what they can to upset progress. They'll do suicide bombing. They'll do improvised explosive devices, because that's all they know how to do. They couldn't begin to go toe-to-toe with anybody's military. And even though they claim they act in the name of God, you'd be hard-pressed to find a religious text that approves of suicide bombing. So these guys are duplicitous to the max. They will continue doing that kind of horrible act that upsets huge numbers in the society. You put off a suicide bomber in one story, you paralyze a whole region. But I think Afghanistan as a country will stumble forward. And I think that if they were smart, they'd ask their women to lead, because it's the women who can yank this very primitive place into the 21st century.
Hey, there is a female candidate, right, running for president? Is that right?
Well, there's more than one. There's several. But I'll tell you something else. A new party has formed, and it's a party that is made up of the leaders of four different tribes, including Sima Samar, who's the head of the Human Rights Commission, including Atmar, who was the Minister of Education. Some very well-known leading Afghan people are part of this party. So I think there's a good news chapter yet to write about Afghanistan, but it's never going to be Toronto or Vancouver. This is a very primitive place.
Now, in the course of your work, you meet these extraordinary women, and you tell their stories, and you obviously learn from them. You gain inspiration from them. In terms of grace, forgiveness, and perseverance, what have you learned most about those attributes from the work that you've done over the years?
Learned about them from the people? Or?
Yeah, from the women that you've met.
Well, you use the word grace. It's such a powerful word. And I can tell you stories of grace from the jungles in Congo. I can tell you stories of grace from the most terrifying places in Afghanistan. I can tell you how people, you know, they don't even have to dig deep into their souls to pull out grace. I have huge admiration for the way they are able to examine the wrongs and come up with methods of solving those wrongs. Yes, it takes grace, but it also takes fury, and they've got equal measures, I think.
What's next for you? I mean, you travel a lot. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. What's the next place? What's the next assignment, I guess?
Well, I'm just back from Afghanistan. I was doing a piece for CBC Radio Ideas.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what's next. I hope something exciting. I'm certainly going to be traveling all over the country talking about this book.
Yeah. This is a book that everyone should read. Congratulations on it, and good luck with it.
Well, thank you, Joseph.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. I've been a great admirer of your work for many years. So,
thank you.
The book is called Ascent of Women. It's published by Random House. Its author, Sally Armstrong, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.